This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Good morning. What should our relationship with the US look like? Do you think Australia is too dependent on the US? And what does self-reliance mean for Australia in 2026? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne. And as we know, Australia's alliance with the US, it's long been treated as a given, almost beyond question. And of course, that's been tested in Donald Trump's second term as president. Overnight, we saw the US blockade of the Strait of Hormuz ramping up tensions. That in turn raises stakes for us and the rest of the world and raises this question of our relationship to the US. Former ambassador to the US and former Liberal Minister and Senator Arthur Sinodinos has argued that while we absolutely need to become more self-reliant, we can't afford to walk away from the US alliance or from AUKUS. Even under this president, that many see as unpredictable and transactional. He'll be joining us soon. I'm going to tease out what Arthur Sinodinos sees as the merits and also the limits of a close relationship. Also what he makes of the opposition leader's crackdown on migrants, that announcement's coming today about the Liberal Party policy that certainly echoes certain moves from a certain US president. What do you think, especially in the light of that looming showdown we've seen overnight in the Strait of Hormuz? What should self-reliance be for Australia? Also this hour, have you found yourself taking your mortgage into retirement, or are you heading that way? Well, first off, you're definitely not alone, so breathe out. More and more of us, particularly who buy later in life and face rising interest rates and, of course, cost of living pressures, will retire with outstanding housing debt. So does that mean our pension system needs to change? What does it mean for what we have on the housing market? We're going to be talking about that. The refinancing inquiries among those aged 55 and over surged 12% year on year in February, and that's the fastest growth of any cohort. So are you facing that? How are you coping? Did you even have a choice? What can be done about it? Also, we've been following the story of suspected sugar glider poaching in Darebin Parklands. We talked about the overall situation with wildlife poaching in Australia. But looking back at that one, this happened back in January, December. But the regulators say there's going to be no ongoing investigation. Is our conservation regulation good enough? The controllers of Darebin Parklands say, look, we've got really strong suspicions here and circumstantial evidence that this is going on, but no investigations. What sort of evidence do we need to prevent or indeed prosecute poaching? We'll dig into that. Also, love them, loathe them, or leave them alone. Harry and Meghan are here in town. Now, look, don't attack me. The angle I want to pursue, hear me out, is sparked by commentary I saw this morning from the UK that essentially Australia is a dress rehearsal for a desire to move back to the UK by Harry and Meghan. And if they can do this trip in Australia and essentially score some marketing wins, whatever that is, that will help. What I'm asking this morning, what we'll explore later on in the hour, is are we being used to improve Harry and Meghan's brand? And if so, will Melbourneites give them what they're wanting? 1300 222 774. We will get to that much later. Gary in Ballarat, you're calling up about our relationship with the US. What would you like to say?
Look, I've got quite a lot of concerns about our sovereignty as far as our relationship with the United States and where we go with foreign wars.
What do you think, that we have to keep them on side, though? Are you in favour of that?
I'm in favour of all countries being on side, but when you get the so much propaganda, you don't know really. The mainstream people don't understand what's really going on unless you follow this stuff and go back as far as the Vietnam War and the uh, and uh, the Iraqi war and where we were in those wars, and to listen to where we are today, it just seems to me that we're heading down the same path where we're going to be pulled into another war that is not in our interest.
So, Gary, you'd say we just don't have enough clear information as to what we're getting ourselves into when it comes to our relationship with the US?
That's right. Correct. Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Gary, thank you for calling. We'll put that to Arthur Sinodine as he's coming up next. Like Gary, call me, 1300 222 774, if you want to express your opinion about whether Australia really can hedge its bets to be more independent but still tied to the US.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, in a recent piece in The Guardian, Arthur Sinodinos has argued that while Australia does absolutely need to become more self-reliant, we can't afford to walk away from the US alliance. Is this a moment to rethink the relationship altogether, or if not, how do we handle that? Retain our self-reliance or even dignity? Or as Gary says, how do we even know what we're getting ourselves into? Arthur Sinodinos is now chair of the United States Studies Centre and joins us from the States. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, hi, Mary. Good to be with you.
We'll go to Gary's point pretty soon. But just so everyone has an idea, if they haven't read your piece, you're arguing that we need more self-reliance, but also that we can't walk away from the US. Is that a contradiction? And if not, how do you see that compromise, if you like?
I don't think it's a contradiction. Being more self-reliant, whether it's in economics, defence or foreign policy, is entirely consistent with having strong relationships with other countries. And in fact, our alliances and partnerships can be a way to enhance our own strength and influence in the world. You don't compromise your sovereignty if you make a sovereign decision to enter into a pact or an alliance with other countries. That's why, you know, we just concluded the EU-Australia Free Trade Agreement. We've done the Defence and Security Agreement as part of that as well. That's why we do the five-power defence arrangement with Malaysia, the UK, US and other... the UK and New Zealand and others, and other things we do in the region. We do these things because it's in our national interest. The alliance, I think, remains in our national interest because the US will remain a player, a big player, whatever you think of the rise of China and the impact that will have on the region. The US is a Pacific power and we remain a big player in the region, and there's no reason for us to necessarily reassess the alliance simply because of one administration in the White House that is polarizing as far as many Australians are concerned. What we find at the US Study Center when we do polling on this is that alliance for support for the alliance itself is very strong, as it is in Japan and Korea, for example.
Is that polling polling of Americans about the alliance? Is that right?
No, it's polling of Australians about the alliance.
Right.
Attitudes on Trump are much more polarized, as you can imagine, right? For some of the reasons that people go to in the calls that they make to you. But the challenge for us is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So my position is we can be stronger on our own shore, but we cannot ever match the access to intelligence, the access to other potential assistance we can get by having relationships like the one to the US. The main question people ask about the relationship is, if we were in trouble, could we count on the US? And the reality is that depends on what the trouble is and what's happened in the region. But the reality is that unless we contribute to the alliance, you can't engender that reciprocity, which leads to them being able to support you when you need them.
It's 14 minutes past 11. You're listening to Arthur Sinodinos, chair of the US Studies Centre and former minister and former ambassador to the US. You're talking, I guess, also, Arthur Sinodinos, about business as usual diplomacy. Yes, we need to keep with the alliance. Yes, because overall strategically we need to be able to count on the US down the track. Hasn't that all changed with a president who has been quite literally unpredictable, who could be tying us into conflicts where there is, to Gary's point, a lack of accountability and a lack of transparency about, well, indeed, motives or even strategy.
So Mary, here's the thing. we've had different presidents in the White House, different prime ministers in Australia, and we've all had to adjust to those circumstances. And the way you handle
are they similarly different, though, if you like? Is this not another scale of difference?
I mean, my point is you have to adjust how you treat presidents according to who they are. Now, in the case of this very transactional president, one of the ways Australia has handled that relationship is by finding other areas of mutual benefit, like critical minerals. And that was the centrepiece of Prime Minister Albanese's visit to the US last year, because that was an area both Australia and the US were seeking to develop supply chains in. So it's an area of mutual benefit. And we did this not because someone rang us up and said, you should do this to please the American. We did this because it's to our mutual benefit to do it. And this is how, with a transactional president like this, you get business done. Other presidents you will deal with in other ways. The reality is, Mary, that presidents come and go, but the reality of our fundamental interests remains that we have to, I think, line up with powerful countries which share our values. And yes, people will say at the moment, are those values under attack because of what's happening in the US? The reality is the US is a democracy where they will work out what they do about Trump and post-Trump. But we have to look at the alliance in terms of what's in it for us. And that's been the issue for the last 50, 60 years that the alliance has been going.
Arthur Sinodinos, you've argued in your piece about the importance of keeping with the American system of alliances. At the same time, Australia's reaffirmed its focus on a quote-unquote mature, stable, constructive relationship with China. Just this month, the Prime Minister has been talking with the Chinese Premier to discuss energy security and so forth. Do you see that as problematic? Is that just part of the diplomacy business as usual that you're talking about, that it's not about making enemies of our friend's enemy, or that we can be playing essentially on all different sides of this?
I mean, it's not binary. We can walk and chew gum. We can have a good constructive relationship with China, but they understand that our priority in the relationship with them is economics and trade, that we don't share the same values. They're a Communist Party dictatorship. That's a bit different to our system. And it's a bit different to the system in the US. So there'll be differences in values in that context. And the reality is we need the US in the region as a balancing power to China. So no one big country thinks they can dominate the region. And if you go and talk to countries in Southeast Asia, they won't do this openly, but they'll say to you privately, we want both, you know, Australia and the US very much engaged in the region. And the US role is as a balancing or counterpoint to China, so they don't feel that they're completely dominated by China.
Mm-hmm. It's 17 minutes past 11. We're talking about our relationship with the US, and I'm speaking with Arthur Sinodinos. If you were talking about we need to keep up this relationship, make it friendly or close enough so that we can count on the US if we need it. At the moment, we've got a US blockade in the Strait of Hormuz. If the US asks us to take part in the blockade, should we send ships, particularly as we know that the Chinese Ministry of Defence has said, well, they expect to be having their transport happen unimpeded? That could lead, in theory, to a showdown in the Strait. Should we be doing this in order to keep our relationship close?
Well, I think there are a couple of aspects here. First of all, our main area of interest is the Indo-Pacific. For us to contribute to the Middle East, we'd have to make a decision that is in our national interest at the present time. In most circumstances, it would be in our interest to just look after our own region. What is in our global interest is if there's a country that wants to develop nuclear weapons that can potentially be used to not just intimidate or threaten its neighbours, but be a basis for funding international terrorism, well, then that country is doing things which go beyond its borders. There are externalities in the relationship that need to be addressed, and we have to think about whether we should be part of any group that deals with that. Now, whether we have a capacity to contribute to what might happen in the Strait of Hormuz, well, that's a matter the Australian government would have to judge. On the issue of our relationship with China...
But just to go back to that, sorry, if you're saying if we have the capacity, we should employ it? If the US asks us?
If we regard it as being in our national interest.
But what would.
And that's a calculation the Australian government would make. And in relation to the Chinese, I mean, they would understand that, Chinese would understand that if we were to be doing something like this, we're not doing this because we're anti-China. We're doing this because we believe in the freedom of navigation of a waterway like the Strait of Hormuz, just as we believe in freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, and we often do operations to show that international law applies in the South China Sea.
Arthur Sinodinos is talking about the US relationship with Australia and how we should keep it relatively close. There's a lot of talk on the text line talking about this country's an abomination and no comparison to predecessors, and it should be condemned and we need to have guts. I guess that takes us to the question of how much actually we gain respect by standing up to the US. We have seen in this second term individuals, political leaders gain respect from Trump when they resist, they talk back, even openly are defiant. And then there's also the factor of people listening who don't want to see that their leaders be cringeworthy in front of the US.
Mary, I would contest that. It's one thing to say that leaders have stood up to Trump, but I wouldn't extrapolate from that that's necessarily earned the respect of Trump or anything else. Yes, for example, European leaders pushed back on Greenland, and that had the desired effect.
And Canada spoke up strongly.
Earned the respect of Trump or not is another matter. I wouldn't go that far. What I would say is that you can get a warm inner glow by saying, we don't like this chap, we're going to have nothing to do with the US. What then? Are the same people who are on the line making this point, what's their alternative strategy for Australia? Neutrality like Switzerland in our part of the world? What about the military? If we want to be self-reliant militarily and not rely on the US or anybody else, are people in Australia prepared to spend 10%, 15% of GDP? What are we prepared to forego as a society to have military spending at 15% because we might want to be like the armed porcupine, that no one want to attack us and we can be neutral in the world?
So you're saying that it's uncomfortable, but we need the US. In your view, what would have to change for that no longer to be true? Are we essentially always going to be in that position?
Mary, I don't think it's uncomfortable. It's just understanding who we are dealing with and adjusting your policy accordingly and having an eye on whether your policy is about the day-to-day or having a strategic eye on Australia's long-term interests. That's all I'm saying.
Mm. Just really briefly, because I know someone wants to talk about this, you are saying that we cannot give up AUKUS. There are many people who now believe, in the light of this second term of Trump, that we are not buying capability anymore. We have bought dependency. At what point can we break that agreement?
I contest that because the AUKUS submarines will be a sovereign Australian capability. Once we have those submarines, including the Virginia-class ones that we buy from the states, they'll be under Australian command.
Are you absolutely confident that President Trump, in his second and final term, will feel the pressure to keep that contract? Hello?
Well, look, I mean, the answer to that ultimately is that you can only go on what's been said to date, which is yes, that they will. The testing point for that will come in 2030 when whoever is the US president at the time will give permission for Virginia-class submarines to be sold to Australia. Now, 2030, Trump by then will be out of office. He can only serve two terms, and contrary to what some people think, he won't be allowed to try and get a third term. So by then we'll be facing a new US president.
Yeah. Arthur Sinodinos, it's 24 minutes past 11 and you've been generous with your time, but I can't let you go before I ask you about the opposition leader, Angus Taylor. He's unveiling the first part of his plan for a migration crackdown today, and it includes social media screening of visa applicants. Migrants who breach Australian values would be deported under a coalition government. That's the proposal. What do you think of the merits and optics of that?
Well, I think the optics of it are that the opposition is seeking to tighten up its immigration policy because clearly there's both a shift in sentiment in the electorate on this, and you see this on all sides of politics, and also you've seen the way in which One Nation has owned the immigration issue, and I think the opposition are seeking to, tighten things up to indicate that they're seeking to reclaim their traditional mantle on being strong on border protection.
Is this the right policy, though?
Policy, yeah. Well, I mean, there are two elements to a policy. One is the numbers that you let into the country, and that's clearly, those numbers are coming down, and both sides of politics are committed to that, but the coalition has made clear that's certainly the direction they'll go in. The second element is the composition, which goes to the contribution that migrants can make to Australia, and as part of that as well, seeing the extent to which people who come to Australia will be law-abiding and whatever. And as part of that process, traditionally, we've looked into the backgrounds of people to see if there are security issues. What the coalition are saying now is they're going to tighten that process and make it more comprehensive, more systematic, have a centre that coordinates information on these things. And I think it is important to make sure we have a good handle on the background of people coming to Australia.
Including the social media screening in particular, that is obviously has its precedent in Trump's America.
But as long as we maintain a global non-discriminatory policy, I think, you know, you can then have a capacity, because I think it's important to keep saying in accordance with Australian values, we believe in a global non-discriminatory policy, but we reserve the right to screen people to make sure that they're not potentially terrorists or terrorist sympathisers. That's what these measures are about.
But how do you feel about the politics of the opposition adopting a Trumpian tactic? It is sort of, you know, it screams at Trumpian tactic. It is many people who look at the election loss was a minus for Liberals and the coalition in general to echo anything to do with Trump's America. Do you believe that this is a good piece of politics?
There are two aspects to this. The first is that some screening of social media has already been occurring, and as I said, it's being extended and made more systematic, so it's not entirely new. The second aspect is, yes, it will have echoes of what's being talked about in the US context, but the impact it will have in the electorate will depend partly on whether you support the policy per se, and people will obviously be split on that. And if they're looking at the merits of the policy, they're not necessarily worrying about whether it's got Trumpian echoes or not. Those people who don't like Trump are probably not already voting for the opposition or centre-right parties. So,
is that a problem for the Liberals?
Sorry?
Is that a problem, though, for the Liberal Party? Because, you know, there's a big cohort that doesn't like Donald Trump here, even in the US. So if you're at that point, isn't that bad politics to then reflect him?
But the politics for the coalition are fraught because it's caught between more of a drift to the centre-right among some of its traditional constituency, they're going to One Nation, and on the other side, it's caught by the drift, particularly among middle class, either to the Teals in some of the previous Liberal heartland seats, or indeed, as we saw in the South Australian state election, potentially to Labor. So it's caught between those two. And that's the challenge, right?
It is indeed a challenge to traverse. Yes, and we are seeing it play out. Arthur Sinodinos, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
No, thanks, Mary. Good to see you.
Arthur Sinodinos is chair of the US Studies Centre, former Australian ambassador to the US, former minister, of course, the AUKUS Forum co-chair as well. Lots of your texts in this age, says Alan, you can't compare Australia to the US. They have the right to bear arms. They walk around legally with loaded guns. No thanks. Herbie in Northcote, you wanted to talk about AUKUS. What did you want to say?
Yeah, good morning, Mary. I believe the AUKUS should be reviewed, especially the submarine deal, because I personally believe we'll never get them, despite all what Mr. Sinodinos said.
You just don't trust the US in this particular administration? Or even down the track? That was Arthur Sinodinos' point. We need to look beyond.
Even down the track. And the reason is America is not building subs fast enough. And part of the discussions there were about that America has to look after their Navy or subs first. And if they're not fast enough, we're not getting it. Mm. And then that goes to the next bit about mutual benefits. Right now, it's one-sided.
Yep. And you don't believe the US will come through Herbie, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it. You've got people echoing here as well, saying Arthur, Australia does not need long-run submarines. Spend the AUKUS funds on many more conventional vessels. That's from Trevor. Kylie says, we would have been stuffed if America didn't take over the strait in the Middle East. Oil and petrol prices would have been much higher. And this saying that I am one-sided, I think it's about me. Why is the fanatic IRGC government not crazy bastards? I know that's the words of Trump there from that texter. They cry death to Israel, apostates and infidels. They should have, and they should have nuclear weapons. That's a rhetorical question there. And this from Jane, there's no way that the US would come to our aid under Trump. We need to cut ties with the US and develop alliances with Canada and Europe. I also want to get to this, though. Are you carrying a mortgage, or do you look like you're going to be carrying a mortgage into your retirement? How do you cope with that, and what can be done?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 29 minutes to 12 on 774 ABC Melbourne. It's The Conversation Hour. Well, refinancing inquiries among those aged over 55 surged 12% year on year in February. I'm asking you, are you among the increasing number of people who are carrying mortgages into their retirement? It's not the dream, but having said that, you're not alone. And what does that mean? How do we change this? Watto from Gisborne has texted saying, yep, 100% taking debt into retirement. What's the situation for you? Did you think you'd get there like this? Or is this something that you've actually absorbed as just a fact of life? 1300 222 774. I'd love to hear your story. Joining me now is Fiona York, who's Executive Officer for Housing for the Aged Action Group. Hello, Fiona. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
I am quoting in those stats, the Credit Bureau Equifax, but your research has echoed the same. Is that right?
Yeah, we've done some research with the team at Swinburne University led by Professor Wendy Stone, which shows that the housing situation for older people across the whole country has really changed. There's housing precarity across all types of housing, and we're seeing not only an increase in the number of older people experiencing homelessness, we're also seeing an increase in the number of older renters and people at retirement age or close to retirement age carrying a mortgage debt. So they haven't paid off their homes at the time when they're looking at retirement.
What has led them to this situation? I mentioned earlier, of course, we've got rising interest rates and cost of living and so forth. Is that what we can put it down to, or is it something else?
I think obviously the cost of housing is an issue for everybody of all ages. I think the issue that we have in this country is that we do have not very many options for secure housing. So you can't blame a person for wanting to get into home ownership, because the reality is you do not want to be growing old in the private rental sector. So of course people want to have that security of their housing as they age, because it's not a great place to be if you don't own your own home. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is that people are also carrying these pretty significant debts at retirement as well. And for older women that have generally lower super balances, this can be a real issue, and they're vulnerable to things like losing their jobs or having to leave the workforce to care for elderly parents or care for their kids, or they may get sick. And that means that they could be all of a sudden in mortgage stress, which puts that security at risk. I think you can't blame people for wanting to own their own home, but the system's not well set up at the moment to support older people to pay off those houses.
Are you heading into retirement with debt, and how do you feel about it? 1300 222 774. Join us in conversation. Fiona York is who you're listening to. She's the Executive Officer for the Housing for the Aged Action Group. You're saying it's understandable for people to want to own their own home, and, you know, it's quite self-evident, I guess, the peace of mind that that gives. But are you suggesting that we need to be considering something else?
Well, if we had better rental laws, then not everybody would need to own their own homes. But I do think that we need to be able to provide better support and have actually more responsibility with the lenders on making sure that we have products, loan products, that assist people to be able to age in place. Because the implications are for people, if you are carrying a large debt as you go into retirement, that it's going to affect your ability to age well. It's going to affect your ability to be able to socialise, to be able to access aged care in the home, and all of those things that we need to be able to age well are put in jeopardy when we've got a large housing debt or a mortgage that we need to pay, or even high rents. So it does mean that there's a bit of a dual system going on where people that own their own home outright are going to be having a much better retirement than those that aren't.
It's 25 minutes to 12 on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne. Let's bring in Nadia Harrison, who's CEO of Mortgage Stress Victoria. Hi, Nadia, and thank you for joining us. What is Mortgage Stress Victoria seeing about this situation? What do you think could be some of the structural solutions?
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me. So Mortgage Stress Victoria is a free service. We're a community legal centre. We've got lawyers, financial counsellors and social workers. What we're seeing is that about a quarter of our clients are over the age of 55 reaching out for help. In previous generations of Australia, that would not be the case. These are people who would have comfortably paid off their home and be looking to spend their money on other things. There's real opportunities for government to look at the way in which the mortgage product can be done in a more consumer-friendly way, and actually a way in which Australian homeowners, including older Australians, are not serving as the shock absorbers for variable risk in the economy. So I'm happy to talk about that as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, Nadia, I'd be thinking, how do I, as an individual, approach a bank? How do I get around this?
So all banks have an obligation to listen when someone reaches out for hardship assistance. That's basically the bread and butter of Mortgage Stress Victoria's work. Our financial counsellors are there to support people experiencing financial hardship, support them to advocate with their bank for sustainable repayment terms and get to housing security. What we find, though, actually, is that the hardship protections and the hardship supports that you can expect to get as a homeowner, as a borrower, vary depending on who you bank with. We've got a range of codes which govern the hardship responses of lenders, and those codes depend on what industry association the lender is a member of, and they vary. So there's a real opportunity, actually, for government to step in and say, lenders shouldn't be competing on hardship. Lenders, that the hardship response should be more of a safety net, and we should have standardised best practice hardship responses irrespective of who you bank with.
Fiona York, I'll bring you back in again. You're from the Housing for the Aged Action Group. Do you believe that there should be a relook at some of these conditions around pensions as well?
Do you mean in terms of raising the rate of the pension?
Yeah.
I think the pension rate, I mean, yes, pension rates are low and they're not keeping up with cost of living. And I think all government support payments do need to be raised in order to get people out of poverty. If you don't have a big housing cost, though, you generally are doing okay. So you might need to be scrimping and saving, but it's much harder for people that have these really large kind of housing costs, and those housing costs may be either rent or they might be mortgage repayments. So yes, absolutely, we should be raising the pension and all government support payments, including JobSeeker. A lot of people that are coming to us are not a pension age yet. They're over 55 and they're really, really struggling on extremely low rates of government support payments, as well as having to do humiliating mutual obligations for people in their late 50s. It's not a good way to be. So absolutely looking at the pension, but then also looking at the housing costs that underlie those rates.
I'm seeing a lot of texts come in talking about different circumstances that can lead someone to this situation, the breakdown of violent relationships, the different life forces that mean that this happens. Do you suspect, Fiona, that this is going to be an increasing problem over time?
Yeah, we've seen the trend over the last 10 years has been that housing precarity is increasing, and that we have seen no reason for that to change. And until we see a real fundamental look at how we view housing in this country, away from housing as an investment and a way to make money towards housing as a place to age well and to have a roof over your head, we're going to continue to see these trends from occurring.
Fiona York and Nadia Harrison, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Fiona York, who's from the Housing for the Aged Action Group. Nadia Harrison is from Mortgage Stress Victoria. It's 20 minutes to 12. This on text from Nick. Hi, I'm about to take on a mortgage at 55. I'll sell that asset at 67 and buy a one bedroom there. This on text, I'm a 60-year-old woman renter. It's hell. 6 monthly house inspections, no security, 12-month lease max, but still always the anxiety of house being sold from under me. I've moved nearly 40 times in my life. And this as well, my mortgage payments are much cheaper than rent. At least my housing is no longer at the mercy of a landlord. I guess that was the dream, wasn't it? If at least that could happen. This from Carl. We bought a house in the Inner West in 2005 with the goal of paying it off as soon as possible. Did it within 10 years. Howard's capital gains tax policy ruined the housing market. I feel angry for all the people who will never own a house, let alone pay it off. There certainly seems to be a line when it comes to our policies and how we are going towards this next phase. This points to it. Heath says Gen X is waiting for their boomer parents to die so they can pay off their homes in their 50s and 60s. Keep those calls and texts coming in. It's 19 minutes to 12. Next, we revisit a story about a suspected poaching of sugar gliders. Are our regulations to prevent poaching good enough? For people who weren't onto this story, we covered it a couple of weeks ago. Over a weekend in early December and again in early January, the Darebin Parklands Rangers saw some things that made them believe that a number of animals, including, well, specifically sugar gliders and microbats, were being poached. There were nest boxes that were destroyed. They're monitored every 3 weeks. The animal numbers are collated. And they sent out something on social media saying, if you know anything, let us know. They took it to the Office of the Conservation Regulator. And the regulator says there's not enough evidence. Joining me is Annette Salkeld, who's Executive Officer of the Darebin Creek Management Committee. Hi, Annette.
Good morning, Mary.
So that was there was an article, I think, about this a couple of months ago. Has there been any more clue as to what actually happened?
Look, as you said, we believe that animals were poached or stolen from the Darebin Parklands. Your listeners might know the Darebin Parklands is a beautiful bushy park sort of nestled in between Ivanhoe and Alphington. It really is like the bush in the suburbs. It was created about 50 years ago, and because it's not such an old park, we don't have a lot of big trees with natural hollows for our wildlife. So we have a large nest box program. We have about 150 nest boxes around the park, which provide that habitat for the wildlife. And they're used by the wildlife. As you said, we inspect them every few weeks. We know what animals are in those boxes. We've discovered that people had entered the park and taken or damaged over 20 of the boxes, and we know that they were particularly targeting certain species, as you said, particularly sugar gliders or crest gliders we have here, which in Victoria people can get licenses to keep as pets. But we suspect there is, you know, a black market that probably runs underneath that. So to us, it really looks like they were poached, as people would have needed, the people who came into the park, to have ladders or equipment to take the boxes down. We know they've targeted certain boxes and they've left others alone that were empty. They seem to know exactly where the boxes were and what they were looking for. They would have had to have tools and equipment to get them down. So that really leads us to believe that somebody has targeted and taken these animals.
And even from what you've described there, you suspect that they must have had some surveillance of the park rangers, that they know that they don't work on weekends.
Yes.
And that the timing of the poaching was breeding season. Is that right? So they were that informed.
That's right. So it's somebody who, or people or persons who have known what they were doing. They've known we're not being here all weekends. We do suspect that they've been in the park and, as you said, surveilled, known our movements when rangers are here and when they're not. And the specific targeting, it wasn't just vandalism. The boxes were taken down and then sort of hidden in the bushes around. So people knew what they were looking, we suspect. It wasn't just, you know, random vandalism. It was quite targeted.
You're listening to Annette Salkeld from the Darebin Creek Management Committee. We're talking about suspected poaching of microbats and sugar gliders. It's 14 minutes to 12 on 774 ABC Melbourne. Annette, also there's the circumstantial evidence, but evidence nonetheless, that there were fewer sugar gliders recorded after that incident, those incidents, than prior.
That's right. As I said, we check the boxes every 3 weeks. We have our rangers and volunteers who assist to look into every box in the park to monitor what's being used, what species are in there, how many. So we've got quite detailed records of the wildlife in the park, and we did notice after this happened that those numbers had reduced. It's possible the animals might have escaped and have gone elsewhere in the park, but, you know, we do suspect that those numbers indicate that some animals have been taken. And no, we can't prove that absolutely, but all of the evidence of what's happened, we really do suspect that the animals were taken.
So, as you say, the Office of Conservation Regulator, you've clearly gone to them, they've looked at it. They say there's not enough evidence to prove that they were stolen or poached. What's your reaction to that?
Look, I think it is disappointing in a way. We haven't been contacted to have any further follow-up or discussion of the evidence that we have. And in one way, it's right. We can't tell who did this. We don't have any evidence or proof of who these people were.
What are they needing, do you think, Annette? Sorry to interrupt, but what do you think that they're needing? Are they needing vision? Do you need to be putting up CCTV?
Look, I mean, it would be very difficult to put up CCTV, and it's not something we really want in our public parks that are here for people to enjoy. And it's a big park with multiple entries. We have nest boxes all around the park, so it's very hard to monitor in that regard.
Do you believe that the regulators should be doing something else, even because you have at least the evidence that you do have?
Yeah, look, it would have been good to have some further investigation to understand if this is a one-off or if this is a trend elsewhere. We know we have anecdotal information from some areas along the creek that it looks like people have been seeking out reptiles, like turning over logs and other habitats. So it seems that there is a bit of potential poaching going on. I don't know what evidence the office might want to pursue it, but certainly with the evidence that we've had, they haven't had the ability or the desire to follow up and dig further into it.
Do you feel you should have more support from them?
It would be good, particularly, you know, getting that advice. They're the experts in wildlife crime in this state, and, you know, they do a good job with the resources that they have. So, you know, being able to get a bit more advice and support on how we can prevent this or what others have done to be successful in preventing this would be useful. For us, you know, we've put the call out to the community, and we think that's our best asset at this point in, you know, asking people to be vigilant and keeping an eye out. And we have a really strong community around this area. We've got a very strong volunteer program. People really do care about this park.
You've said that it's never in fact occurred in the park, and it came as a real shock to your staff.
It was. I mean, we've had this nest box program for over 15 years. It's been highly successful. It's one of the biggest in the country. And it was a real shock and a real dismay to the staff who work really hard to maintain this park and to look after the wildlife and create the habitat for them. It's very dispiriting, but you know, having some support on how to prevent this would be useful.
Mm. And just finally, Annette, is there anything you can be doing or are doing to try to prevent this happening again, even if you can't get the Office of Conservation Regulator to take action?
Yeah, look, and we've obviously put a lot of thought into this because it is a really important thing. We've had a very talented expert on nest boxes help us over the years, and he's designing some new nest boxes that will pop open if they're removed. So that's one thing that we're doing. And leading up particularly to next year's breeding season, we'll be putting a call out to the community just to make sure that people are on the lookout and have some very active people out in the park, particularly at the times where the rangers aren't here, to keep an eye out for any unusual activity.
Annette, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Mary.
That's Annette Salkeld, who's the Executive Officer of Darebin Creek Management Committee. It's 9:09, and I want to get back, if I can, to the texts that are still coming in about all of us who are retiring with mortgages still. But let's also move on to another topic. Listen, I swear to you, I'm bringing you a different angle. We're going to be talking about the non-royal trip. Yes, Harry and Meghan are in Melbourne today. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this is because I heard a really interesting take on their visit. Have a listen to this. This is Matt Wilkinson, who's the royal editor of The Sun. Yes, it's a Murdoch-owned corporation. I know what you're feeling about Murdoch and the royals, but have a listen to what he believes is the story behind the story of this tour.
If you can succeed in Australia, if you can do that without any dramas, and they're going to be watching very carefully about how the Aussies, because they're clued up, Aussies, you've got Republicans and you've got pro-royals, they will be clued up and they will be watching very carefully of the reaction, how it all goes down, to hopefully do it as a blueprint to bring them both back to the UK. And this is what I'm told from, you know, from inside the kind of, inside the Sussexes.
So that's the theory, that the Australia trip, royal tour or not, is a sort of a brand exercise, and that the fate of that brand exercise rests in our hands, apparently. How we react to Harry and Meghan, how will you react? Juliet Ryden, author and ABC Royal commentator, joins me. Juliet, hello. Is this all a brand softening up to go back to the UK? Have you heard of this theory before?
I have heard this theory doing the rounds in the UK, yes. The UK feel very strongly that Harry wants to come back to live there, wants to come back with Meghan and his children. I don't know whether it's just wanting to come back to do some visits or wanting to come back to set up completely, but of course we don't have any evidence of that. He does go back to the UK. We've seen him go back for those court cases, but he also will be there very importantly next year for his Invictus Games in Birmingham in July. And I'm sure he would like to think that he will get a good reception for those games. So there may be an iota of truth in it, that this is testing the water a little bit. But, you know, Australians are very different to Brits. And what I can say is that the British reaction to Harry and Meghan is very different to the Australian reaction to Harry and Meghan.
In what way?
I believe that we cut them a bit more slack, that there is an understanding of why they left their roles within the royal family, that we accept that they're a couple who want to own their own lives and have set up a, you know, rather enviable life in California.
So you think we're a generous audience?
Constantly bash them for it.
So if we're a generous audience, it makes even more sense that they'd be coming here. It's essentially a soft launch to go back to the UK.
I don't know. I think there's a bit of a stretch. I think they're coming here because they were invited to two private events, which each of them are speaking, and they built this sort of tour around that. My bigger question is why they do that, why they build these semi-royal tours around what are private events. Why don't they just go, if they want to go and visit charities, why don't they just do that privately if they want to understand the race, you know, understand what is going on in the mental health space here, for instance, which is part of what Harry is doing on his engagements.
Isn't the theory that they need the cash?
Big tour following.
Isn't the theory that they need the cash, Juliet?
Well, they're not getting paid for those charity
No, but for some other events?
Well, my understanding is that the InterEdge Summit have not paid Harry to speak there. I don't know about Meghan. I haven't had any response from that. I suspect she is being paid for that event. But
I think
Harry
there was a three-day...
to speak there.
I believe there was an event... you know, which cost in the thousands to attend with Meghan.
Correct. That's the wellness weekend here in Sydney. And I'm sure she is being paid for that. But, you know, it would have to be a lot of money to pay for the entire tour.
What I think intrigued me, Juliet, is this idea that of clued up Aussies who can make or break Harry and Meghan's brand. Of course, they have stopped the royal or non-royal walkabouts. They won't have the crowds potentially around them. But what do you think constitutes a marketing win for Harry and Meghan while they're here?
Well, I think that they would they will hope for a positive reaction, of course, from the people that they meet, and I'm sure they will get some of that. They'll probably be also hoping for a bit of positive media, and so far it's very mixed. So we'll see. You say that there won't be walkabouts and there won't be organised walkabouts, but they are in public places in each of the cities that they're visiting. So there is potential for people to see them on the streets here in Sydney, over in Melbourne, also in Canberra. So, you know, people may turn out to see them, certainly when at the end of the tour, Harry is sailing on Sydney Harbour. So people can go down and watch that.
Yes. Juliet Bryden, have fun out there with the binoculars and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Juliet Bryden is ABC Royal Correspondent. This from Melissa, you wag. Did they get working visas? Yes, we could run that past Angus Taylor and see what sort of questions they got at the border. And this on mortgage stress. What if the boomers spend it all before they die? That'll put a spanner in Generation X's works. That's from Jamie. I think we should get into this topic again. It's got a lot of response. Thank you for joining me today. You can listen to this again by finding the Conversation Hour on the ABC Listen app. And also write to me. Tell me what we should be covering. conversationhour@abc.net.au. Have a wonderful day and take care out there. I'll talk to you again tomorrow.